Hey folks, Tony and I are really excited to continue our partnership with Ruiz Auto Services, All American Used Cars and Trucks. We got some great new specials here for Ruiz Auto, located at just south of 90th and Fort here in Omaha, 4839 North 90th Street. Just talked to Esmeralda the other night, and here's what we got for the next couple of months here. Saturdays, if you are looking for a free inspection and check on your air conditioning, all you have to do is say a pen and a napkin sent you in, and the crew at Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust will check your air conditioning. They will inspect it, and it will be for free. Also, on Saturdays, while you're there, you need an oil change, right? Just it's a Saturday ritual, especially in the summertime. Go in and get your oil change. If you mention a pen and a napkin, it'll be $50 for your oil change, start to finish there at Ruiz. If you're in the market for a new set of tires, mention a pen and a napkin here over the next month or two, and the crew at Ruiz will give you a free mounting and balancing on your new set of four tires. That's a great deal, because that's probably, gosh, that's got to be a good $100 at least for the mounting and the balancing on the new tires. Just mention a pen and a napkin, and they're going to give that to you. So Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, All American Used Cars and Trucks, Esmeralda and Juan Carlos have been terrific to a pen and a napkin. They want to be terrific for you as well. They do great work, and I think you should check them out. So please go check out Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. If you're in the market for a used car, All American Used Cars and Trucks. Afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 133. And I'm sorry, folks, you're just back to just me and Tony. It's yes. Can we get the other guy back, please? For the love of God. Great podcast last week with Coach Berg. That was a lot of fun to change it up like that, I thought, Tony.
Yeah, they tell you the difference between a rut and a grave is just, you know, the depth there, and doing something different like that was a lot of fun. I was really impressed with him. Yeah. Just his matter of fact, and he has a message, and he sticks to that message, and just did a really, really nice job.
Yeah, he's no Chad Angel, but he's good,
I mean, you can't measure putting somebody to a standard of perfection like that.
Yeah, there's greatness, and then there's perfection, and that's the difference that we're talking. So we are going to talk here today, episode 133. We are going to talk about attacking aggressive defenses, and we'll go into a little background with that. But before we do that, Tony, 1949 NBA champions, do you know who they were?
No.
Minneapolis Lakers, the beginnings of the, I think we're going to hear that quite a bit here over the next few
Mike's
weeks.
Young?
Yeah, some Mike and guy. They named a drill after him. They beat the Washington Capitals 4-2 in the NBA Finals. Fun fact for you, Tony. The head coach of the Washington Capitals, a gentleman by the name of Red Auerbach.
I think he went on to do some.
He did a couple of things, which that may come up in the following bit of time as well. So that was 1949 NBA championship, 1949 NCAA championship. Kentucky, I believe, repeated. I'd have to go back into my archives here. Yes, they repeated. They beat Baylor the year before. Adolph Rupp with the first back-to-back NCAA champions. They defeated Oklahoma A&M 46-36. The head coach of the A&M Aggies.
Lemons?
Nope. But Henry Iba. Henry Iba. Mr. Iba, as
Bobby. Might be an arena named after him.
Yeah. Abe Lemons, I was, so I'm working on a different project, and I was watching an old game on YouTube, and I'm talking like 1983, 82-ish, and Abe Lemons was the color commentator with Skip Carey on the game. So how's that for a throwback for you?
It is a throwback.
Yeah, so so there's your basketball history lesson of the day here, Tony. Attacking aggressive defenses, and I, this kind of popped into my head as we're watching the NBA playoffs play out, especially watching the Thunder and all of the fits that they have given teams, and you know. Later on today, we'll get into the finals and have a more in-depth discussion there. But, you know, especially at home in front of that crowd, just the ball hawking, attacking, aggressive defense. And it is unique for the NBA level to have just a team of 6'6" dudes that are just after you, after you, after you, after you. Usually NBA teams played quite a bit more conservatively, but the Thunder are coming right after you. They're very handsy. They're very physical. It's hard to put the ball on the floor against them. And, you know, some have said this might be the best NBA defense ever. I say, let's pump the brakes on that a little bit. Let's let them win more than zero finals games before we start anointing them in that manner. But that's kind of the brainchild of where Tony and I are coming from this week, because you're going to play teams at the high school level, at the college level, who are going to be really athletic, really aggressive, and how you attack them is really important. You've got to get through it. You know, I know in my experience, you know, Kelly Flynn had his great program at South Sioux City, and they were a ball hawking, attacking defense, very physical, and forced a ton of turnovers. And we had to figure out ways to beat those teams. And so that's kind of the 30,000 foot view here for Tony and I here today. You know, Tony, anything to add just kind of on that overview?
Yeah, I mean, part of going back with what you were talking about with the Thunder's defense, Rick Pitino, who knows a thing or two about basketball, he said the only team in the NBA that he watches their defense is the Oklahoma City Thunder. But I agree with you. I mean, let's let them win a finals game or two before we anoint them as the best defense in NBA history. But their defense is very similar to what we try to do. Not that we're nearly at that level at Kennedy. But
come on, Tony. You got to do that, man.
Yeah. And so I really enjoy watching them play defense, how they fly around and switch and just super aggressive and trap and all that fun stuff. But there are some things that you have to be well-versed in. Otherwise, they're going to run you off the floor. And it looked like they were going to do that to Indiana in the first half. And then lo and behold, Indiana hangs around and give Obi Toppin and Nembhard credit that they were able to make some plays. And then Halliburton, and understandably so, because of, you know, making the shot that puts him in the lead with 0.3 seconds left, gets a lot of credit. But if it's not for Toppin and Nembhard, his shot would have cut it to 8.
Yeah. 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 It was a crazy game. You know, we'll, like I said, we'll get to that, and we'll dive in depth with it later on here. You know, I think, Tony, and I'm guessing your list is probably pretty similar to mine. What at least I can only vouch for myself, what I'm going to talk about is not exactly brain surgery or anything like that. But it's more about the repetitions of what I'm going to talk about here today. And I'm guessing yours is very similar.
Very similar. There's nothing in here that's like, oh, okay. I mean, there's a few things that you know, with certain sets and different things that are key when you know what's going to happen. But Oklahoma City doesn't always do the same thing all the time. And so you have to be careful. You may be sitting fastball. The next thing you know, you get a 12-6 breaking curveball on you and you look a little bit silly.
Yeah. A lot like Kerry Wood in 1998. But
yeah, 20 strikeout game.
Yeah, the greatest game ever pitched in baseball history, literally by the numbers. But, you know, that's what it's been called that anyway. So, and then his elbow blew up and he was out for the year. But anyway, who's really upset?
They don't
about
blame
that?
The Cubs pitching coach with him and Mark Pryor.
No. Yeah, geez. Yeah. Anyway, I can't complain. I saw one World Series championship in my lifetime. I can't complain too much. So,
they get a couple starting pitchers, Marty. You might get to see them.
Yeah. It's been a good start. We'll go Cubs corner for 20 seconds. It has been a good start, but it's early June. The offense has been humming along really well. You got nothing to complain about. You're 4.5 up, 40-24. But it's a marathon, not a sprint. And if we're still 5, 6, 7 up in mid-August, then we can start getting really, really optimistic. But you just got to keep banking wins. That's the same is true in every sport. You just keep banking wins, and get them when you can. So
I like that philosophy, Craig Counsell.
Yeah, I'm going to do the rest of the podcast in Craig Counsell's batting stance. We're done. I just cramped up. Oh, that's it. Yeah, so
I like the waltzes, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So we better start talking about basketball or we're going to lose all four of our followers here. So attacking pressure, in my mind, Tony, is literally that. It's a mindset. I think you've got to sell to your team that they've got to be comfortable with that uncomfortable pressure defense in your face. You got to have that mindset of it. It's kind of like if you're a quarterback or if you're an offense in football, we actually want them to blitz, because if they blitz, if we handle it right, we're going to have big play after big play after big play. And I think the same thing goes for attacking pressure defenses. Hey, if we do what we're supposed to do with the ball and dictate things the way that you have been trained to dictate things with the basketball or on the offensive end, we are ultimately going to come out on the other side the victor, because we are going to be more disciplined than their attacking defense. I think that's kind of one of the first things that might be the very first thing that you sell when you're talking about attacking pressure defenses.
Yeah, and a lot of times they have to be comfortable just playing basketball, because if you can make one or two really good passes, and again, the big word there is if you can make those, you're going to play 3-on-2 and 2-on-1. And so if you can get your guys and gals just to be able to make plays like pass and catch, meet passes, get your head up, find the open player, you literally are working on 3-on-2, 2-on-1 type situations. And, you know, when you put all that risk out there, if you can do fundamental things, you're going to get rewarded.
Mm-hmm. What's your first bullet point?
One of the first ones I would go with, I said, you got to have good spacing, because here's the thing. If you can spread a defense out, now you're making them guard you one-on-one. And I know that seems elementary and really, really simple, but that's so very, very key. Spread them out, make them guard a player or guard territory. But when you start to break down your spacing, now one player can guard two. And now you find yourself in trouble, because now they're going to blitz you and trap you. And then as you get in that situation, you got to try to throw a cross-court pass. That's when you find yourself in trouble. But if you can keep good spacing and not pinch together, that really, really helps you out. And that really hampers them, because it's going to create both driving and passing lanes for your offense, which I hear are good things.
Yes. Well, and if you have good spacing, Tony, when they, let's say they run and jump you, they're coming to trap you, that's just more space that they have to leave their offensive player, which makes it that much. And it may be only an extra step or two, but that extra 4 to 6 feet are a really, really big deal in that situation.
Well, definitely. The more territory you can make them guard offensively, the better off you're going to be. I remember, when just watching John's teams play 10 plus years ago, when I first came across his path, is they would really do a great job of spacing, where they would start their offense out so much further than other teams. And and they would just continue to spread that defense out, which opened up driving and passing lanes, and they would put an offensive clinic in just based off of that spacing alone. But if you can make people guard, and I know it seems simple, but an additional 4 to 6 feet, like you said, you're going to be in great shape offensively.
Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. These days, players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deals, and branding creation. However, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp, it's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort, east of Los Angeles, before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, Livesey's school was a place for the game's greatest coaches to teach the game throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slykus, adopted Livesey's curriculum, bringing the school to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa in 1994. This summer will be a celebration of its 30th anniversary of Snow Valley in the Hawkeye State. Here, over 1,400 campers will start each day before dawn and end after the sun goes down. Snow Valley Basketball School is America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. For those that come there every summer, it is the home to the last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, will be available on Amazon on July 1st, 2025. Paperback copies will be available for $17.99, while Kindle copies will be available for pre-order for $9.99. Get to know the story of America's longest continuous basketball camp. One of the things that I think it's important that you do is it's a daily emphasis without talking about it on a daily basis, you know. So I wrote down as my next bullet point, Tony, fall back to the level of your training, which is something that you know, I would think about all the time. Now, it's something I very rarely used with my teams. I would very rarely use that phrase, but as we would coach practices, and I'll use the South Sioux City example. Every year, the earliest we would play them would be in our conference tournament, which would be like the third week of January, right around January 20th or so. And if we didn't play them in the conference tournament, we didn't play them till it was literally the last game of the regular season. But especially when we were trying to break through and we were in consistently in the same district with them, on November 15th, I was thinking about how we were going to pass and handle the ball and break traps, getting ready for that game on February 20th against South Sioux City, because I knew ultimately that's who we were going to have to go through to win our district. And so it was never said, hey, on November 15th, hey, we're doing this to get ready for South Sioux on February 20th. No, never was. It was never said. But was it thought about by myself as the head coach? Absolutely. So, you know, as you think about pressure defenses, you need to, in attacking pressure defenses, you need to think of the team in your conference, in your league, on your schedule that attacks you with the most pressure, and prepare for that long before you get to that point. Have that in the back of your mind as you're preparing your team on a daily basis. When you are doing, you know, whether it's a designated passing drill or a designated ball handling drill, or it's just in the flow of things, this is what we need to do to beat that team. And I think that if you think of your pressure drills, your everything that you're doing there in that vein, you're not rushing 2 days before you play them on February 17th. We couldn't start doing that stuff on February 17th and expect to have it by February 20th. We had to start it way back then, so it becomes that habit of being prepared for that. And this is the way we execute all the time, not just for this. So I went on a little bit of a tangent there, Tony, but I think it made sense.
It definitely makes sense. I think when you are taking a look at your practice planning, don't get me wrong, you don't ever want to overlook people, but you want to make sure as you're putting things together that you are putting things in there for the best team you're going to play. Mm-hmm. You don't ever come out and say, hey, this is in your situation for South Sioux City. I know that we have, you know, whoever else before that, but this is for South. No, you're always going to do things at a level and an intensity and whatever the case may be from a schematic standpoint in preparation to play the best team on your schedule. And so I have no problem with that, no fault with that, because if you can handle, you know, the teams that get up into you and provide that pressure and trap you, whether it's full court, whether it's half court, whether they hard hedge screens or whatever the case may be, you're going to be able to handle those teams who dial it down defensively and aren't ultra aggressive. But you've got to start to build those habits early on, because like you say, you're going to sink to the level of your training. There's no doubt about that. You are going to go to that level. When it hits the fan, the proverbial bullets or whatever, are flying, you know, you're going to go back to that level of training. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little Bobby Knight and, Mr. Iba, and Bobby Knight, and this is kind of the way I thought of things. I'm sure it's very similar to you, Tony. You're not playing against your opponent. You're always playing against the game of basketball. And I just, a little preview here of the opening tip newsletter for the next volume here. I just finished Belichick's book, The Art of Winning. And he mentioned that on a couple of occasions that, it was always about the next play and playing against the game of football and our execution and focus like that. So I think when you're talking about that training, that's exactly where you're coming from. And that's the way you also have to think of it. Or another way you can think of it is you're playing against the game of basketball. You're not playing against South Sioux or Cedar Rapids, Kennedy, or whoever it may be. That's who you're focused on. So,
You're focused on, your best. That's who your greatest opponent, the one that looks back at you in the mirror.
Yep. What's your next point, bud?
Another one that I talk a little bit about as well, we talked about spacing earlier, and I think that's an important thing. But the other thing to keep in mind as well, out of that spacing, when that trap happens, look to flash somebody to that middle. And I think that really, really hurts defenses, and it doesn't always have to be to the middle. Sometimes if you get trapped in the wing, you can step them out short corner rather than flash into the high post. That short corner release is also another good one as well. But one thing to kind of keep in mind, especially against teams that like to trap, avoid over dribbling. Because if you can look to pass the ball, rather than try to dribble through it, you're going to be in much, much better shape. And if you can get the ball in certain positions, and one of the places that almost every defense hates to have the ball there is in the middle of the floor, whether you're in a press, whether you're in the half court, whatever. But if you can get the ball in the middle of the floor, you flash into that middle, you can really do some damage, especially against those aggressive trapping teams.
Mm-hmm. You stole one of mine here, Tony, to a degree. One of the things I wrote down was to step to every single pass. And, like you said, flash back to the ball, come back to it, find that open space. But whatever you do from whatever angle you're coming to, you've got to step in and receive that. A lot of teams when they're attacking, and you see it with Oklahoma City and to a lesser degree Indiana. I mean, let's not sell the Pacers short here. They're a pretty good defensive team as far as applying pressure and making things uncomfortable for teams as well. But you've got to step to that pass. You've got to step to it, grab it, rip it through. The phrase we always used is receive it well. And we would dummy that rep all the time. We had a drill, we called it cardinal passing. And we made sure that every time the pass was thrown, we were jumping to it and catching the ball with two hands and 2 feet. And again, it's about building those habits and falling back to the level of your training. So you to a degree, you stole one of mine there, Tony, but I forgive you, my friend.
I appreciate your forgiveness.
Yeah. So, another thing, and again, this seems elementary, it's very simple, but this is where it all starts at. You've got to emphasize your kids to be strong with the basketball. And you just can't say it. You just don't say, hey, be strong with the ball. Well, no crap. That's what we should be doing. But, catch, get those elbows out. We'd say rip it through. It's your space too. is one of the things I wrote down here, Tony. It's your space too. And, you know, a lot of teams, a lot of pressured defensive teams, they want to try and force you to bring those shoulders back. And you can visualize what I'm doing here. I'll try not to cramp up like I did with the Craig Council batting stance. But, you know, they bring your shoulders back and you're playing tentative and everything's off your back foot here. Instead of taking that, leaning it in, ripping it through, staying strong. If there's a double team, I'm going to rip it through, split the double team, make a good pass out of it, or whatever it may be. And that's just, again, strength with the ball. We used to do just for like 30 to 45 seconds at a time, ball slams. We would just have our players take the ball, elbows out, up by their chin, and we would just have their partner just slap at the ball as hard as they could. And I mean, the whole purpose is just trying to knock the ball out of our hands. And we would do that a couple of times a week for a sum total of maybe a minute and a half. So we would dedicate 3 minutes a week to it, but it emphasized what we were talking about with being strong with the basketball. So that's another thing that I had written down.
You know, and one of the things, we have a drill, we call it Wartburg ball handling. We're working on front pivots, reverse pivots. We're working on making sure that we, you know, step wide and different things like that. But part of that drill as well is we'll put a manager, an assistant coach, or whoever, and we'll double the ball. And we're working on stepping wide to get them to spread apart and then make a long step down the middle with strength. And so some of the things you're talking about, we'll do. And then the other thing that we like to do as well, we like to do a zigzag where you pick it up. We let them harass you for 4 seconds. And then when I say 1,005, the defense is going to retreat step and it's live one-on-one to the rim. But we're trying to get them used to not getting nervous when the pressure happens, whether it's a one player by themselves or a trap or whatever the case may be. But you have to rep that stuff so they can keep that poise and composure, because it's not a case of if the traps are going to come, it's when the traps are going to come.
Mm-hmm. Yep. What else you got, buddy?
You know, another thing, that just things that I know that give us fits from time to time with the type of defense that we run, that would also look to incorporate backdoor cuts. You know, we played today, we had 3 games today, and our last game we're down 16-4 early on, and I bet you we got scored on 2, 3, 4 backdoor cuts out of it. And those things are hard because you want to get up, you want to overplay, you want to be out in that pass lane to get that steal. But if they give you a good pass fake and you bite on that, then you get caught ball watch and they back cut you, that can be really, really tough to defend. And so backdoor cuts specifically from the wing, and not that the top of the key isn't also effective, but we find the wings are a little bit more challenging for us at times. But backdoor cuts from the wing is hard for an aggressive trapping type defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I feel like you activated the camera in the A Pen and a Napkin studios again, Tony, because the next thing I had on my list was not only back cuts, but slip screens, ghost ball screens, or back screens, you know, setting a flare screen or a back screen, you know, different sets. And I think when you teach your players, kind of leading to a bigger point here, when you teach your players how to just play the game instead, and this is, you know, definitely my evolution as a basketball coach, instead of talking about, you know, we're going to run the flex or we're going to run the high-low game and station to station to station to station type of stuff. Teaching your players how to play the game and making reads and, hey, slip that cut, or, hey, let's run our tap play, but instead of setting the screen, ghost it and slip it or whatever it may be. That helps negate the pressure because, you know, again, with scouting the way that it is today, if teams can scout you well enough to take away your patterns by trapping in certain places in certain spots, you're done, you know, and it's more than likely than ever that coaches are going to be able to do that. So it makes it more pertinent than ever to try to teach your players just how to play. And that's where your back cuts come into play, your slip screens, your ghost screens, your flares or back screens there. So I like where you took that, Tony.
Yeah, those two actions specifically the slip and the ghost, really, really hard for us to deal with in terms of our type of defense. I think anytime you can make defenders have to communicate with each other and then execute out of it, that puts the offense at an advantage. Mm-hmm. And so that would be something that I would always look to incorporate those communication pieces, whether it's a slip, whether it is a ghost or whatever. And I know with our type of defense, it frustrates us, but it's almost any type of defense, to be honest with you. We have those actions in as well, out of our sets, and we usually are able to score at a pretty high clip.
Mm-hmm. What makes it so difficult for you guys with what you do? I don't want you to give away too many of the Kennedy secrets here, but guarding those slips and ghost type of things, what makes that so hard for it to guard for you guys?
What happens, especially with those two actions there, I'll just go with the slip first. When we're a big, heavy switching team, And so when you go up, the player that's guarding the screener, we like to get them over the top of the screen, so it's pretty a natural thing. And then the guy that was guarding the ball who received the screen, it's hard for them because if they stay, it allows us to get under it, and we take away that slip, that roll, whatever you want to call it. And so if you come up and it's kind of pre-planned in and the guy doesn't have the time to get under it, that slip really hurts us. The ghost hurts more from the standpoint of, again, we're supposed to switch that thing. And so you're trying to communicate the screen, and all of a sudden, wait, it wasn't a screen. He just kind of ran by it. He ghosted it. And then sometimes especially with my level, with the younger guys, it's just really hard to get them to talk. Mm-hmm. And so by the end of the year, we're pretty good at it. But in the beginning of the year, that action causes a lot of issues as well, just because young guys sometimes don't like to talk. I know that surprises you.
Yeah. Yeah. Stunning. Stunning, Tony. Stunning. I got two more things. What do you got, buddy?
The next thing I would go with, and this is more in the full court, but if you can get the ball inbounded quickly, I think that helps as well. And so whether that's a designated inbounder every time, whether that's, you know, multiple guys who can handle the ball, but if you can get that thing out of the net and get it in quick before that defense has a time to set, you're usually in pretty good shape. One of the things that was frustrating for me today, we'd score and try to get ready to get into our press, and the next thing you know, it balls in, balls up ahead because we're jogging back, we're not seeing it, and we're getting scored on in transition, which should never happen in that situation. But if you can get the ball in quickly to somebody who knows what they're doing and get guys running up the floor, that also can be something that negates a little bit of that full court pressure.
Mm-hmm. Well, the longer, and that's the, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, because a lot of times teams that are pressuring, what do they want you to do? They want to make the game chaotic. So you're like, well, we need to slow down, stay disciplined, run this and that. But sometimes that plays into the pressure that the teams are trying to give you. You know, I remember, and I'm going in the way back machine, back when I was coaching with Mike Power and Jamie Sale at Briar Cliff, we were running our run and jump. And the longer that it took for teams to get set up against us, boy, we were just like sharks after blood in the water. I mean, now you're going to try and set up against us. It was the teams that got it out quickly and pushed it up before we could get matched up. And we were really, really good at getting matched up and finding our people and finding our spots and our various pressures. But it was, you know, getting that out quickly. I think you're right, but you got to be smart about it where you don't, you know, and that's where that discipline comes in. Yeah, we want to get it out quickly and we want to beat it before the pressure gets set up, but we also don't want to get sucked into that running game if we're not fully equipped to do so. That's kind of that's the yin to the yang, don't you think, Tony?
Yeah. Yeah. You have to be careful because if they are aggressive, trapping, run, gun, whatever, and all of a sudden you're getting it in quick and you begin to engage in that, sometimes by taking a bad shot or playing faster than what you're comfortable at, that can lead to the pace of play they want. And eventually over time, they may wear you out. And then all of a sudden you get 2-3 turnovers in a row. And the next thing you know, it's a 6-8-10 point run. You're like, whoa.
Yep. Yep. One of my two things, and they're kind of related, but I'll start with the first one here. When you get fouled, and you're going to get fouled, you know, that's the trade-off. If you're a pressure coach, we used to say all the time, fouling negates hustle, but you also understood that we're going to foul a little bit, but, you know, kind of like the Oklahoma City Thunder philosophy of, yeah, we're going to foul, but we think we're going to get more out of it by being aggressive than we would be by not being aggressive. And, but when you do get fouled, when teams are coming at you, when you do get fouled, you've got to sell that contact. You've got to show that you are, yes, indeed, we are getting fouled here. Now, again, you get fouled by staying strong with the ball, by ripping it through, et cetera. But it's important to be able to sell that contact. When you do get fouled, hey, we got to make sure that it gets called here because what's, you know, fouling negates hustle. You know, when you foul too much, it slows the game down. If your best player gets a couple of fouls early or your two best players get two fouls in the first quarter, that changes the dynamic of the game. But you've got to sell that contact. The only way you sell that contact is by staying strong with the ball. So that kind of ties into a couple of different things there, Tony.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, it's a deal where when you try to take a charge, you sell that, don't you?
Yeah.
And so it's the same type thing here on offense. When you are feel like you're getting hacked or pushed or whatever, you want to sell that. That makes a lot of sense. And then your coach is going to stand up and speak out for you as well. Hey, you know, watch the reach, watch the hands, you know, that type of stuff.
Yep. What else you got, buddy?
My last one that I'll throw with here real quick is sometimes you can do things to get yourself into a mismatch. Now, one of the things a lot of times that the teams that like to pressure hard like to do is they like to switch because you can always provide ball pressure that way. Mm-hmm. And so there are special things that you can do, whether it's, you know, the wing or the point guard screening for the post player. And the next thing you know, they switch their smaller defender on your big guy. And now you can get that ball inside and exploit that mismatch a little bit. Now, there are counters to that that the defense can do as well. I'm not saying, hey, it's as simple as throw it to the wing, you know, point guard screens away, run big man across, we throw it inside, you've got the point guard on him every time. There are different things to it, but there are certain things you can do, kind of like that whole slip and ghost, but there are certain things that you can do to get a matchup that you want against a team that's ultra aggressive with a switching defense. And so keep some of those things in mind as well. If they switch frequently or they overcommit, that can lead to a mismatch, whether it's throwing the ball inside on that or whether they cheat across so much in help, you can screen the weak side in and throw those flares over the top as well. But there are certain things that you can get because of how they do it to take advantage of that. So that's just something else to kind of keep in mind as well.
Yeah, you've got to make them pay for pressuring you in that way. And looking for those mismatches is one way to do that. Absolutely. I agree with you there, buddy. That's good stuff. The last thing that I had is when you get fouled, and as the fouls pile up, hopefully for you, because you're staying strong with the ball, you're receiving the pass well, you're slipping, you're cutting, you're setting ghost screens, etc., make it hurt. Hit those free throws. And again, it seems simple. There's a reason why they call them free throws, right, Tony? They're free. But you've got to make your opponent pay for those missed shots or those fouls, excuse me. You got to step up to the line. Players got to step up to the line. They got to knock down those shots. And when you don't make them, you're kind of letting, I always felt like we're letting them off the hook. You know, they got away with something when we don't make them pay at the end of it by hitting both free throws of a one-on-one or a two shot or whatever. We've got to, you know, the foul hurts. Let's double down on the hurt by knocking down the free throws and tacking points on the floor or on the scoreboard, because that's the ultimate, obviously the ultimate judge of the outcome of the game.
Yeah, you've got to make sure when they're vulnerable and they're not guarding you and harassing you from that free throw line that you make that. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is as you attack and play downhill, whether you're shooting a layup or whether you're finding a teammate for a layup, you have to finish those bunnies at a high rate. If you can finish those, then maybe you get them to back off a little bit. You know, and things to kind of keep in mind, and this is kind of what you alluded to earlier a little bit. Well, duh, you know, it's easier said than done, but make sure, like we've kind of emphasized earlier, play with poise and composure. And the other thing too, with a lot of times against an aggressive team, they're going to be in what I would describe maybe as overhelp position. Like they're really, really close. They can double you easier. But on those skip passes where they have to run 15, 20 feet, whatever the case may be, make sure you attack that closeout.
Mm-hmm. Coaching today is, let's be honest, it's harder than it ever has been. And the demands on us, the things that coaches are asked to do, the lengths that we are supposed to go to be the best coach that we can be, it's becoming more and more difficult. A lot of coaches come into their coaching career and they feel really, really good about their X's and O's knowledge, the technical aspects of the game. And I was very much the same way. That's what I thought coaching was all about, but it's so much more than that. It's about being, especially at the high school level, and you can say the same thing at the college level or even the professional level, it's about being the CEO of your program. Folks, I think I've put together maybe the best thing I've ever done, and that is my third book coming out here this fall, 365 Days of Hoops. A one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO. And what I was able to do was to put together 365 separate concepts of what it takes to become a basketball CEO of your program. This is all divided into basically 10 different areas: book studies, coach studies, X's and O's. So you gotta know what the 2-3 zone defense is all about. Zone sets, defensive tenets, whatever that may be. Culture, building a great culture at your program. Your game day execution. What are you doing on a game day on a daily basis when you're going into competitions? Skill development. Personal development, finding time for you, taking a vacation, handling failure, creating your resume, practice, how to build a great practice, how to become a great practice coach, off-season workout ideas, and miscellaneous coaching topics. 365 Days of Hoops has those 10 topics subdivided into 365 different things that you need to do as a basketball coach. At the end of every page, there is space to journal, to write, to X's and O, everything that you need to do to take that topic, to think about it, and to think about what you are going to do. This is going to be available early this fall. Don't have an exact date yet, but I wanted to put that out there for you coaches so that you know what's coming out here. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you. One thought a day, take 3 to 5 minutes every day to think about it. And by the time you're done with this book, you are going to be really, really be prepared to be a basketball CEO of your program. So keep your eye out on it for 365 Days Hoops, a one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, coming this fall from a pen and a napkin. Well, Tony, you know who is always not only attacking closeouts, but they just attack everything all the time with what they do. Tony, my friend, it is your turn for trivia. What do you have for me?
Yeah, you know, you take a look the other night, Tyrese Halliburton hit a game winner. Seems like he's hit a few of those this postseason.
Just a couple.
And my question, because I think you would pretty easily get who has the most game winners in playoff history. But we have a tie for the second most. I'm wondering, who do you believe has the second most game winners in NBA playoff history?
So I think I saw this. So I think Michael has the most with 8. We talk on a first name basis. You know, he calls me Marty. I call him Michael. I think isn't it LeBron is tied with Halliburton for second now?
LeBron has one of those spots, but Halliburton is not at second right now. It's somebody else.
Oh.
Because Michael has 9, LeBron has 8, and LeBron is tied with one other player.
Game winners. I'm going to say Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
It's a really good guess, but it is not Kareem.
Before or after Kareem?
It would be after Kareem.
Kobe.
Kobe it is.
Aha! Yes, and it counts. Very nice. How many? Kobe had 5? Or no.
He and LeBron both had 8.
Yep, he both had 8. And Michael had 9.
Mike had 9.
Okay. Hey, that, you know, I tell you what, that feels good. That makes me say.
How about that?
And speaking of how about that, Tony, how about that game 1 the other night? I was just watching it and tell me what you and again, we're a couple days removed from it now, so we've got a chance to digest it and hear the pundits talk about it a little bit, but your thoughts on game 1 of the finals?
Dumpster fire first half for the Pacers, and you kind of felt like they should be down double what they were.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think the Pacers do is they should keep the audience tuned in, because this isn't the first time they've looked like, man, the wheels are about to come off this thing. And then the next thing you know, they kind of stick around. And in the last 3 minutes or 1 minute or whatever the case may be, they come back and they steal it. And so that's exactly what happened. Like they couldn't take care of the ball in the first half to save their lives. You know, they were lucky to be close. Obi Toppin, I don't think you necessarily had him on your bingo card to hit 5 threes, but he has 5 threes off the bench. I believe 17 total points. Nembhard hits a really nice step back on the MVP. And then the next thing you know, it's a 1-point game. You're like, Halliburton has the ball in his hand. I think he only shoots like 86.7% in those situations. But when it left his hand, he kind of felt pretty good. And the other thing too, you know, he's a good enough passer because he had Siakam. If Caruso steps at him hard, he's going to stop Siakam in that short corner. And Siakam's got a really great look too. But Caruso peeled off on Siakam a little bit, which allowed Tyrese to get that shot off and knock it down. And I really feel like Indiana stole one. I'm a little bit nervous for Indiana in game 2, because I think they're going to run into a kind of an upset and mad Oklahoma City team. But at the same time, if you're Indiana, you won game 1, and I don't think you played particularly well until the last three and a half minutes.
Mm-hmm. Tony, here is what I would compare the Indiana Pacers run to right now. Are you ready?
Ready.
Hello there. I seem to have fallen down a cliff. I'm still alive, but I'm very badly injured. I think my legs might be broken, but I'll try to stand up. Ah, yes, they are broken. Perhaps you could toss me a band-aid or some antibacterial cream. I'm in an extraordinary... a large amount of pain. The bone has gone through the skin. I feel it might be gangrenous. The wound is beginning to smell a little like almonds, which is not good. Please? No one?
Sorry.
I'll try the other leg.
They just won't die, Tony. They just won't die. So, I was thinking, you know, everything that you said, I wholeheartedly agree with. This is the, as Bill Simmons would say, this is the Michael Myers team. They just don't die. They just, yeah, you can't get rid of them. The sum is better than the parts in many ways, but at the same time, all of the pieces fit really, really well together. Coming off of the key component, which is Halliburton. And what Indiana has done in their front office, in their drafting, in their smart free agent signings is, okay, here's our best player. This is, you know, kind of like what they did with Reggie Miller. We're never going to get LeBron or, you know, Kobe to come here as a free agent. The only way we'd get somebody like that if we're gonna draft him, but we're never bad enough to draft somebody like that, yada, yada, yada. So our best player is always going to be kind of that next tier down, but we're going to be really smart about who we surround them with. And if you take a look at the history of the Pacers, they're one of the few teams that is, you know, for the last 40 or 50 years, they have just never bottomed out to, like, you know, 15 wins. They've always been solid, and they've got a really good infrastructure. And I think in a lot of ways that infrastructure is playing itself out. I think Rick Carlisle has done a masterful job of manipulating his roster. He's still playing 9 or 10 guys. You know, Obi Toppin came in and played great the other night. It's just been an amazing, amazing run. It's got to, let me quiz you with this, Tony. Does this give you a little North Carolina State 1983 cardiac pack kind of vibes to it on an NBA level?
It does. You know, they seem like they're a team of destiny. And, you know, Rick Carlisle, I just don't think gets enough credit. He and his staff always seem to have a really, really good game plan. Like, you go through and take a look at some of the surprise firings, whether that was Mike Brown at Sacramento, and it seemed like there was one or two others, including
Taylor Jenkins, Thibodeau,
who we'll talk about a little bit, yeah. But there seems like there was at least one other. It's been after they have gotten really out-coached by Rick Carlisle and his staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and give him kudos for change. And I think we might have talked about this with Greg Berg the other night. You know, he used to be the guy that used to call every single play and dial it down. Now he's just like, go, just play, just let it rip. And we're going to play this kind of controlled chaos type of game. But the ball is always moving. The players are always moving. Somebody said this is, and I think this is the perfection mark when we think of this. But around 10 years ago, we had the beautiful game with the Spurs. And this is about as close as we've come to that level of ball movement, player movement, unselfishness. The sum is better than the parts. It's been a decade since we've seen kind of something like this. Do you agree, disagree? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a masterclass in coaching, and I give Rick a lot of credit. I mean, you take a look at what he did in Dallas, and then, you know, with Dallas, you have a lot of resources. Mark Cuban obviously has a lot of money, wants to win, different things like that, and Rick's like, I think I'm good here. I'm going to go to Indiana, and he goes to Indiana, and he's watching things. He's like, you know what we need? We need a really, really good point guard. And so they traded Sabonis, who was their best player at that time, for Tyrese Halliburton. And I think they saw in Halliburton what he could become. And I think Tyrese has even said, I think they saw greatness in me before I did and had bigger expectations of myself than what he did. And now he's playing at that level. But I would say this, I mean, Tyrese Halliburton's a really, really good player. I don't know if I would say he is a superstar, but he is, he's booming right in front of our eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. And now, with all that being said, with all the praise that we have heaped upon the Pacers over the last few minutes, the Thunder did lead for 47 minutes, 59.7 seconds the other night. I don't know if I've ever seen a game where a team has led for less time. I mean, literally, you can't get really much less than 0.3 seconds, I guess 0.2 or 0.1, or you win at the buzzer. But I've never seen it play out of that way. You know, 47 minutes, 59.7 seconds, the Thunder led the game the other night. So I think the closest I ever came when I was at Fort Calhoun, we trailed all but the last 4.4 seconds of a game at one point, or 3.4 seconds. We trailed the other 31 minutes and 57 and change, or whatever it was. So overreact, underreact, how do you properly react if you're Oklahoma City, Tony?
You know, the thing I would give you with Oklahoma City is they played well. They really did. They didn't finish the game well, and they need their second best and third best player to play better. Chet Holmgren, not good. First time in the finals, Nurse have a role in it, most likely. Jalen Williams didn't play well. I think he shot less than 33% from the field. Again, those guys have to be better if Oklahoma City is going to be successful. The thing that I was really interested in is you saw before the game even began, the chess match that Carlisle did where they pulled Hartenstein out of the lineup and they went with Cason Wallace. And to me, Carlisle won that by making them adjust before the ball even went up in the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I think they got a little too ISO heavy. Shea shot 30 times, I think they ended up saying. And another thing, that I can't remember if you said this or not, Tony. I apologize if you did. Indiana out-rebounded them by like 17 or something like that, which helped negate the 19 turnovers in a half by an NBA team. I mean, that's
unheard of.
That is unheard of for an NBA team. And it was just a weird game. I think we all picked what everybody else has picked, OKC in five. Probably going to be hard to still get it in five, in my opinion. But do you still have Oklahoma City in the series, Tony, or have you?
I'm staying with Oklahoma City. I still think Oklahoma City is going to win. It's the difference between an NCAA tournament game. This was the NCAA tournament. Oklahoma City would be out.
Yep.
It's the difference between an NCAA tournament game and an NBA series. People forget that Denver. Aaron Gordon hit a three to beat Oklahoma City. And I know the series went seven. But the last time I checked, Oklahoma City did win in seven. Yeah. And so whether Oklahoma City wins it in six or seven, whatever the case may be, I still think if you win four games, you still win the series. And so I would still rock with Oklahoma City. But game two is about as must win for Oklahoma City as I think any game outside of the game two of the Denver series was.
Yep. I agree with that. Kind of historically, I heard this on a podcast. Historically, in these situations, the team that's heavily favored in the series but loses game one at home usually blows out their opponent in game two. And call me crazy, but I do agree with a couple of the pundits. I don't see Indiana getting blown out by 30. I just think they play. I don't think they're scared of anything at this point. Like, we've gone into Madison Square Garden and we've won. We've knocked off Cleveland when they were supposed to beat us, and all of these different things. And now we've got another feather in our cap by winning game one here when there's no way in the world we should have won against this team. So I think it's going to be a good game, game two. And again, if you folks haven't figured it out, we're recording this before game two here. Tony and I have some conflicts on Sunday, so we're recording this on Saturday. So I think it's going to be a good game. I think every game is going to be a competitive game. Do I think Oklahoma City is better over the span of seven games? Absolutely, I do. But I think this changed it to, okay, a five-game gentleman sweep to this has got a chance to go six and maybe even seven, and I think they're going to be really, really competitive games all the way through.
Yeah, and to sit here and say, you know, oh, it's two small market teams, nobody's going to tune in. If you have a good product with good teams playing in it, people are going to turn it. Mm-hmm.
Coaches have really enjoyed the opening tip newsletter that has been coming out from a pen and a napkin here for almost a year now. Every 2 weeks, on the 1st and the 15th of every month, you're going to get a newsletter with an article, a podcast, a bonus podcast. You're going to get some coaching videos on there. You're going to get some book recommendations, a lot of different things that are coming out here with the opening tip newsletter. It's really driven towards a little bit more of a personal written form of what we do here at A Pen and a Napkin, which, of course, is to help coaches get better, to hone their craft. And so I use a lot of my own personal experiences. We use other people's personal experiences. We try to go into the lab with coaches. We try to get into the nuts and bolts, a little bit more of a visual compilation of things that we do here at A Pen and a Napkin. So if you haven't subscribed to the Opening Tip newsletter, you need to do so now. Go to Substack.com, find the Opening Tip newsletter and subscribe to it. Or if you find it on Twitter here, go to it, check it out, subscribe to it. It's going to be a really, really good thing for you to check out. So check out the Opening Tip newsletter on Substack from A Pen and a Napkin. Tony, let's we're kind of running up against the time here, so let's go home on this. The other big headline that came out of the basketball world this week, kind of the only way that you would overshadow the NBA finals, is either the head coach of the LA Lakers or the New York Knicks getting let go, or maybe the Boston Celtics, I guess those three franchises. And lo and behold, we had that happen this week. Tom Thibodeau let go. Tibbs was there for 5 years. 5 years in the NBA is a long time. And he did a great job on the floor. You can't argue with the results. They made it to the second round of the playoffs last year, and maybe without injuries, they make it to the conference finals. This year, they do make it to the conference finals, where they lose a tough series that, if you look at it, if they hold on to a 15-16-point lead in the last 3 minutes of the game in game one, maybe they're the ones playing in the finals right now. But this is the way of professional sports these days. I think there's deeper issues than just the winning and the losing, but you can't argue with the results that Tibbs had. What say you, Mr. Viss, on the parting of ways between Tom Thibodeau and the New York Knickerbockers?
You know, When you watch that series a little bit, somebody put out there that I think it might have even been Stephen A. Smith that Tibbs may get fired if they lose. New York went all in. Like, they moved all their chips in the middle of the table. Mikal Bridges, Karl Anthony Towns, yep, so on and so forth. They put everything in. And, you know, you take a look at coaches and the standards that they're held to. You know, it's like, oh man, Tibbs a lifer, Tibbs a grinder, Tibbs, you know, been in the NBA forever, was on Van Gundy's staff, so on and so forth, got his own chance, seemed to have done a good job, whether it was in Chicago, New York, Minnesota, wherever, seems to have done a good job. You know, I take a look at this Knicks team, and this is not a typical Tibbs team. Like, Tibbs usually gets grinders, they're hard-nosed, they play defense. And that really wasn't the calling card of the Knicks. Like, I'm not trying to be mean. Jalen Brunson is a great offensive player. Karl Anthony Towns is a very, very skilled big man shooter. But both of them are below average defensively. Yeah. And OG Anunoby can't guard his guy and a second guy every single night. Same with Bridges and so on and so forth. But you take a look at some of the things that were going on at the end, like, they're openly questioning Tibbs, like, hey, we should be starting Mitchell Robinson. And it was Josh Hart who was saying that. And guess who Mitchell Robinson was going in for? Josh Hart. And so there began to be some telltale signs that maybe things weren't great in Gotham. And then ESPN.com put out an article on this whole thing, and it made a whole lot of sense. Not saying I agree with it.
Yeah.
But it just made sense. And I think the Knicks are looking at a home run. Like, you're not going to get rid of Tom Thibodeau and hire some guy that's wet behind the ears and throw him a huge payroll that they're paying luxury tax on and don't have any draft picks until, you know, 2074. You're going to go after somebody. I really think that there is, you know, they always say where there's smoke, there's fire. Mm-hmm. There's some smoke there with Jason Kidd. You don't get rid of Tom Thibodeau if you don't think you can't get somebody of Jason Kidd's quality. And I really believe that Jason Kidd or somebody of that stature is going to be the next head coach of the New York Knicks.
Yeah, I think it's, you can't bring in some first timer guy. I could see, I think probably the best fit from the coaching perspective is a guy like Taylor Jenkins. I think he's a pretty good basketball coach. Now, it's different. This is not Memphis. It's New York City. It's a tremendous amount. It's much more attention and pressure on the product. You're dealing with a media conglomerate that is much different than anything else. But I think he might be, when you're talking about being in the gymnasium, he might be the best fit, the best thing that this team may need right now. I think that it's a good, it's a good starting five, but like you said, Tony, there's holes there. Jalen Brunson and Cat are not very good defensive players. I think probably the Tibbs thing of the limited bench. I mean, those first two rounds against Boston and who'd they play? Who'd New York play? Detroit. They basically played six and a half guys, you know, and that's hard to do at the NBA level. You know, you need, what Pat Riley say, you need to trust seven, play eight in the playoffs. And you may think, well, that's only one more guy, but that's one, that's a big one more guy. Now there's, you know, payroll, what do you call it? Cap space implications with that. You're paying Cat a bunch of money. The front office is firing Tibbs for not using the bench that the front office didn't provide for him either. You know, it was a top heavy rotation. What have I said the last couple of years, Tony? Two stars in depth. Two stars and give me six guys that know what they're doing, instead of three stars with not a lot of depth. And you know, that's where the Knicks kind of fell short. So it will be interesting to see what roster adjustments they make as well to fit whomever they end up hiring here. So I think, I don't know, time will tell. If they hire, let's say, Jason Kidd, and they win a championship next year, which they very well could, especially with a very weak Eastern Conference, Boston's going to be down. Who knows what's going to happen with Giannis? So now you're looking at Indiana, New York, and maybe, you know, Detroit's on the rise. Orlando's, and did I say Indiana? I said Indiana. I can't remember. And Cleveland. You know, and that's about it. You got to go through two other teams instead of that. So I mean, it very easily could happen where they could get to the finals. But I think it's not as much about Tom Thibodeau as it is. I think he may have been a factor, but I don't think he was the factor as to why they didn't get to where they wanted to go.
I think that's fair. You know, I know we mentioned the lineup change. I know they were talking about playing more guys off the bench, whether it was Miles McBride or you playing, you know, moving Josh Hart to the bench, you know, and different things like that. But you had guys openly campaigning for him to play more players off the bench. And that was kind of the squeaky wheel there at the end too. But I agree. I think, you know, he might have had some impact in it. He was not the factor in it. And one of the things you go back to is what you were talking about. If you're going to spend all your money on three players, four players, whatever, your stars, and then you put, you know, some other guys around them that can't play, when the money's on the table, you know, you've got some issues there. But I know that the Knicks really, really like Leon Rose, as far as his what he's done with some of those moves and things. So it wasn't going to be him that was going to be the fall guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a lot easier to get rid of a coach than it is a bunch of players, right? I mean, that's, yeah, you know, that's the old adage, yep, you know. And so the coach is the first one to take the downfall. You know, I had a really good point, Tony, off of something that you said, in agreement with what you said, and now I forget what it was. I'll remember it as soon as we get done here. So,
on later.
Yeah, exactly. So, how about we just leave it at that? We have no points left to make here. So, other than episode number 133 in the books, attacking aggressive defenses, Tony, anything to wrap things up with?
You've got to look at these. The way, like, it's a copycat world, right?
Yep.
Oklahoma City is 68 wins, might have had over 70 if Holmgren had been healthy all year. You're going to see more and more teams. Oh, this is the recipe. Look what Oklahoma City, this is the secret sauce. And so you have to be able to win as a defense. And it goes back to kind of like we were talking about, fundamentals, but also some really, really good common sense strategy, backdoor cuts and flashing to the middle and ghost screens and slipping screens and stuff like that. Stuff that you got to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that daily preparation, and we both emphasize that, the daily preparation of what you're going to do, prepare to play your best teams at all times. You fall back to the level of your habits in your training. And so I think that's what you do. You're not, if you're playing the pressure team on Friday night and you got 2 days of prep and all of a sudden you're just preparing for it now, it's going to be a long Friday night. It's going to be a long slog. Yep, exactly. So episode 133 in the books. Want to thank Tony for his time. Like I said, we both have pretty busy weekends this weekend. So it's a confluence of stuff here. Check out, we got The Last of the Cowboys coming out here by the time, about 3 weeks or so, folks will be able to get at it. We've got the Hoops 365, one-year guide to becoming a basketball CEO, is in the process of getting finished. Just a lot of really, really good things coming out from a pen and a napkin, so check all that stuff out. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.